Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by political consultant and columnist Ray Hanania, political consultant John McGovern, and Steve Sevlick of the Chicago Tea Party Movement. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Chicago's fashionable Near North Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. That's where we have streaming media of this program that lasts for many, many months. In case you miss a show on each week, you have a chance to find it on our website. Well, tonight in the first hour, we're going to be talking about the budget battle and the need to cut spending in Washington, D.C., and ideas that you may have to do that. And in the second hour, we're going to be talking about the growing problem in Libya and U.S. foreign policy there. But let us begin with, of all the budget issues, the question that is literally before the House and Senate and the White House at the moment is whether or not the government will be shut down this coming week because of the failure of both leaderships in Republicans and Democrats to come to some sort of a compromise. And Steve Sevlick, I'm going to start with you. You are our Tea Party representative on the program this evening. So your group has been putting pressure on the Republicans, many of the freshmen who carry the Tea Party banner. What is your prognostication of what is likely to happen this week?
Well, what is likely to happen, I mean, just to put on the pun in hat, I think they probably will reach a deal because they can see that the American people support more spending cuts rather than having the government shut down. Rasmussen poll came out and it showed that people by a margin of 57% to 31 want to see more spending, even if it means the government getting shut down. So I think the Democrats are going to see that the writing on the wall, and they know that they're not going to come out on top if the government gets shut down. They're going to try to make a deal. And
John McGovern joins us. John is a Republican consultant, and for many years he was press secretary to Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert when he was the Speaker. And John, you have been sort of inside the discussions when some of these decisions are being made, and certainly an integral part of how that message was going to be delivered. What is happening now, and can you describe the level of pressure that Republican leadership must be under right now?
Well, I think that's a good phrase, is the pressure, and it's the freshmen. There's a very large freshman class that has come to Washington to really change things, and they're going to be on the hook at the next election for what they deliver. And I think they're putting a lot of pressure on leadership to make some cuts and to really try to turn this thing around. Now, at the same time, I agree with Steve, though. I think it's very unlikely that you'll have a shutdown. And I think the fact that Jay Carney and the president have been out there saying, well, you know, we need to roll up our sleeves and get together and get something done and make some concessions. I mean, you're starting to see that people are trying to move to the middle to avoid being blamed for a government shutdown, which, of course, is what really hurt Newt Gingrich when he was speaker and Republicans were in charge back then. But I think what's more important is really not about this budget battle. It's about the 2012 budget, which we're going to be hearing a lot about starting next week. This is, if you remember, we're just talking about getting through the next few months of,
right,
of this budget.
Until October.
So, you know, I think there'll be a deal, and I think you're going to see the real fight is going to come over the 2012 budget, because that's where you have the opportunity to make some very significant changes and some very significant cuts.
And thus far, they have agreed on $10 billion in cuts. They'd like to move that number from $10 billion to $33 billion. I don't know whether they're going to get that far. But I want to ask Ray Hanania. You are a former talk show host, journalist, author, a stand-up comedian, a variety of things, observer of the world.
It just tells you what the economy
everything
is like these days.
You're doing it all. You got a lot of
commentary
jobs
on the economy.
But my question to you is, do you think that people are out there cheering for a government shutdown?
No.
Because they really want to see drastic cuts?
No, I don't think they are.
Or are they looking for someone to blame?
I think the average person out there has a difficult time understanding some of the things that are debated at the Washington level sometimes when they get down to very specific cuts, why something is or isn't important. I think what they want to see is something that's going to impact their lives, and they don't want to see government divided between two sides that don't get together. So, you know, this time around, I think the burden is going, you know, into the next 2 years is falling on the shoulder, you know, of the Republicans and the Tea Party partners. And I know you don't like to be called a Republican. Is that correct? But
that's correct.
But I think the burden is there, and I think that they're going to get a better response from the Democrats in terms of working together than the Democrats might have gotten if they were controlling the House.
Well, Steve, I couldn't disagree more, and here's why.
But go ahead.
The only reason we're here is because the Democrats didn't even pass a budget. So they left town without
well, right. We're here because we built up a $1.3 billion debt over the last 10 years, and with a projection going over the next decade of another $6 trillion. So it was the pressure and the bad economy has put us in the position.
And people see that there's only one party that's willing to make any cuts.
I don't think if they you look see at that.
Also, John McGovern.
Well, I was just going to say, Ray, you know, it wasn't over 10 years. It's really been over the last year. I mean, this administration has so drastically spent and escalated. I mean, we're talking $1.65 trillion for this year.
But, you know, when he took office, it was $1.3 trillion.
But Ray,
I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to make this point. It's like you with your home budget. If I'm in debt, I'm going to get into more debt. That's just the way it is. If I'm not in debt, I'm going to be able to pay off bills. So my goal right now, I want to get rid of my debt. And it's not easy to do when you have a debt. So the burden was on Obama when he came into office, and it's not easy to shake it off, even though it was less than what it is.
But he continued to spend. That's the problem. He didn't try to mitigate it. He continued to spend. And whether it's the stimulus or all these other programs, it's the largest government intervention in the economy.
You mean like when he tried to cut tax?
Has the president, in your view, Steve, and again, you're a Tea Party guy, has the president shown any sign at all to you that he's willing to bend a little bit on this issue?
No, and he hasn't had any leadership on this. He presented his budget with minuscule cuts, if at all. I think with all the debt we're drowning in, it's kind of hard.
Has he not cut enough from traditional Democratic constituencies?
He hasn't cut anything, period.
Plus health care. Plus, you know,
the Democrats are proposing 12 hours worth of deficit spending cuts. So if we fund the government for the entire year, Democrats say, well, let's cut out half a day of spending. And that's just not enough at anybody's view.
I think that's a good point, though. I mean, you know, Bruce, $30 billion, $50 billion, $10 billion, $30 billion. That's nothing. I mean, that is a drop in the bucket compared to what the real problem we're facing is.
Yeah, but how is all this, rhetoric changed from when they wanted to target Obama and just bring him down, where that was a priority goal? Just if the average guy on the street is listening to this, how are they not convinced that maybe it's the same old politics, that you just want to take Obama out in 2012, and that's what we're dealing with, not the real concerns?
I want to get everybody a chance to respond to that and also get reaction from those people listening coast to coast and border to border as we take America's political pulse now on the budget battle in Washington. Not only the one about the government shutdown coming up maybe in less than a week, we're also talking about the big battle of the budget, which starts next Tuesday in the Capitol, and that deals with 2012, which starts on October 1st. 1-800-723-8229 from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks for joining us on Beyond the Beltway. Let's head right to calls. Tom, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Tom.
Yep.
Hey, listen, Congress, the next step they have to do is vote to not increase the debt limit. They have to vote no increase on the debt limit. Everything else is just bogus negotiating. Secondly, we got to get rid of John Boehner because he's just Nancy Pelosi with a pink tie.
All right. Well, let's first of all, whether you agree with that, the latter part of that, because the Tea Party was very critical of Boehner, you know, before the shift took place. Now that he's been Speaker for several months, is your verdict still the same?
well, we want the Republicans to get serious about the debt and deal with the Republicans. On Tom's first point about the debt limit, I agree with Tom and I agree with Senator Obama, because when President Obama was a senator, he took to the floor of the Senate and argued that we can't increase the debt limit because we're robbing from our children and we're destroying our economy. And I agree with him then and disagree with him now.
But then at the time, though, he's in his last budget speech, Obama came back and said that he was kind of put in a position where he had to increase the debt. And he is against it, that he doesn't want to increase the debt.
Ray, when he came out against raising the debt ceiling, the debt was eight times less than it is now.
You know,
what are the ramifications for not raising the debt ceiling, John?
You know, frankly, I think it's discipline. It forces fiscal discipline on people who have to make some tough decisions. And you know, I would agree with the caller and Steve. You know, if we just allow that to keep raising that ceiling, that allows people to keep spending more money and finding more creative ways to increase the debt. And unfortunately, I think the political process there, you know, it is prone to a lot of deal cutting. And I think some discipline will force people to make some hard choices.
Realistically, do you think is there the political will to make that hard vote right now? Marco Rubio was they tried to pin him down on Fox News today as to whether or not he would absolutely vote. And he kept saying, you know, he wouldn't say absolutely not, but he said, oh, it's a horrible thing, you know, and not to do it is worse than to do it. But he still wouldn't actually come out and say the words, I am going to, you know, refuse to vote for this, and all the ramifications, the fiscal ramifications that will follow, be damned.
I think that anyone that does vote for increasing the debt ceiling better get something out of it. So get a balanced budget amendment or get some kind of limits on what they actually are going to spend. Because just to vote,
he had 4 points he wanted.
Yeah, just to vote for the increasing the credit card with nothing to get out of it, that's a wrong vote.
Why didn't they argue about limiting the debt, placing a debt ceiling before? To me, it's political. When you get a president that comes into office and says the way out of the problem is to spend and to get Americans to spend and government to spend, that's the way to break today's bad economy, why shouldn't people think that that's not political, that now suddenly we have people from a party that spent 10 years, you know, increasing the debt and spending without having all the money? I mean, both sides do it. I'm not just saying it's the Republicans. Both sides do it.
Well, you know,
why now?
Well, frankly, we don't have to raise the debt ceiling if people are going to make some tough choices, right? I mean, I don't understand why the argument's about we do or don't have to raise the debt ceiling. How about getting this thing under control? How about getting spending under control? How about getting the budget under control? But to your point, we've had a president who has just spent and spent and spent and spent more and spent more and spent more. There's no discipline. There's no real belief that he's serious about being disciplined.
But isn't he spending on programs that the prior administration didn't want to spend on? Isn't that part of the problem?
I don't think that's the point. The point
is Steve is shaking his head.
Yeah,
well,
I'm
shaking my head because John's boss overspent and Ray's president overspent and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid overspent. They're all overspending. Ray brought up, what does the regular guy think about this? And there's a very easy example of why we can explain the debt. If anyone listening to the show right now just drives to McDonald's, order up a Big Mac, a side of fries, and a large drink, not even a diet drink, get one of those sugary drinks. Take one of those French fries, cut it in half, and put that fry off to the side. That's what the Democrats want to cut in spending. Now, after you eat that meal, ask yourself, are you still hungry? Are you being starved? Or are you going to get fatter and fatter if you eat that? And
well,
that's what we're doing.
You're leaving out an important factor, though. When I'm driving up to McDonald's, I'm using a credit card with a 20% interest rate. We've been taught
McDonald's.
You're making my point.
A lot of people are. No, but a lot of people are forced to do it. They don't have the money. So we are seeing more and more people use credit cards. And we have a public that's used to spending what they don't have. How is it that we can't get the public to change and we expect the people that we elect to change? I don't see it happening.
Well, I think leadership to me is about explaining.
It's not going to happen.
What needs to be done? Not just to say, folks, you know, you're involved in wasteful spending in your personal life. And by the way, we're going to show you how to do it.
Yeah, but
we're going to do it as a Congress.
But Ray, I think that's not right because I think that has changed. I think people have cut back. The whole foreclosure.
The economy is forcing us to cut back, not leadership.
Well, no, of course there is no leadership.
If there was leadership, they would have said, look, let's put a rein on the credit card companies.
You're saying the public is conditioned to overspending and being in debt.
Right.
I don't think that's right. I think the public is far ahead of government because they're the ones who have to meet their own budgets and run their own lives, whereas government continues to spend and spend and spend without the consequences that an individual or a family has, whether it's a foreclosure or bankruptcy or all the other things that have been going on in this economy.
And people's spending levels have decreased. Yeah. Their savings have gone up where politicians are going in the opposite direction.
That's exactly right.
Let's go to Sally listening to us in Chicago on WLS. Go ahead, Sally.
Hi. To the Tea Partier, and yep. I don't have his name.
It's Steve.
I'm Steve. Hi, Sally.
Okay. As part of the budget cutting, and I always, you know, I never hear this, and I'm curious to find out if you are willing to cut from your district. In other words, if the budget supports a museum or a school or some other project in your district, as part of this budget cutting, are you willing to go in and cut your district also?
Yes, absolutely. I'm willing to look at anything, including defense, because we are in a crisis. We have to get spending under control.
So your
I'm willing to take your cuts, Ray's cuts, John's cuts. Let's add them all up and let's get it done.
So this isn't just about NPR.
Go ahead, Sally.
The voters who voted for you are willing to accept that also.
I'm not a politician, and thankfully
so. Oh, okay. Well, the
major... Sally, let me ask you. Let me just turn the table on you and ask you that question. Do you think at this moment in time there are constituents who vote for a member of Congress who understand that for the good of the country, not for the good of a particular congressional district, that certain cuts have to be made, which means there will be things done of an unpleasant nature in your congressional district? Have we reached a point where we can have that discussion and 435 congressional districts can at least come to a realization that what's good for their congressional district may not be good for the country?
No, because it's always not in my district, okay, and not in my city. All right, it's always
is
cut
that
somebody
Sally
else's...
in your view in your view is that selfishness on the part of the voter, or is it ignorance on the part of the voter because they don't understand the big picture and their role in it?
I think it's selfishness. Now, I'll give you an example of what's happening in Ohio. The governor just passed an anti-union bill, and it included the firemen and the policemen. Guess who is out there petitioning to recall the governor and the legislators? The firemen and the policemen. But had they not been included, they probably wouldn't be out there petitioning.
Sally, you're probably right about that, but can I ask you a question? Who do you trust to make decisions about how your family lives? Do you trust yourself, or would you rather trust your politician to take care of you? Who do you think is going to make the better choices?
Well, okay, you're looking at apples and oranges, okay? I mean, I actually – let me just say this. I think that there's another way around this, and I always ask, why don't they try this instead? Why don't they try going to a four-day work week like some businesses go to? Why don't they try a total freeze on spending, a total across-the-board freeze on spending?
I'm with you, Sally.
All right, there's some alternatives instead of cutting the budget because you know why? The needs of the country keep growing. The country keeps growing. The needs keep growing. We have people who are unemployed. They're not paying taxes. You know, we have, even though the unemployment rate went down to 8.8%, guess what? It's going back up because the state and the cities are now getting ready to cut jobs. So there are other ways of handling this budget instead of cut, because you're never going to cut it down to zero. You're never going to get there.
Well,
As long as I live, are you going to get to zero?
I don't think anyone is suggesting that all the budget be cut down to zero, but I think what they're saying is there has to be some review of which programs work, which programs do not work. And one of the things that has happened in this country, and it's Republicans do it and Democrats do it every 2 years, it's the old line, bring home the bacon. Have you brought home the bacon to my district?
Exactly.
And in their brochures, any member of Congress, again, regardless of party, regardless of ideology, they're telling you what they brought back to their particular district, whether it's roads, libraries, whatever the case may be. The point is that, you know, in many of these cases, it's these earmarks that are asked for by Republicans and Democrats that the folks back home love to read about and they like to hear about it. But that's how we get into the mess that we're in right now. We have not been able to say, members of Congress have not been able to say no to people who ask for favors. They have not been able to do that, and that has led to the mess that we have right now. 1-800-723-8289. We'll continue our discussion about the budget and budget woes. In your opinion, 1-800-723-8289 when we come back from Chicago. From Walla Walla, Washington to Barron Springs, Michigan, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations as well as Sirius XM satellite radio. Our guest this evening, Ray Hanania, is here. He is a one-time journalist, a stand-up comic, a political consultant, a former talk show host, a columnist for the
Jerusalem Post,
and also the author of the book, Arabs of Chicagoland.
It's must read at FBI headquarters these days.
Everybody, right? Yeah. And also, since the last time you were on this program, you went through a rather serious
heart surgery,
and you're alive and well.
And I was so happy that the doctor said, "You know, Ray, you've been a journalist for 32 years, and yes, you do have a heart." So I was
and
really
they
happy.
It.
And the insurance was there, fortunately, but I would have taken.
You look good and relaxed.
I would have taken government-funded health care. I don't know. Okay. Would I have lost money?
John McGovern also joins us. He has been involved in political campaigns for a long, long time. He is the former press secretary to House Speaker Dennis Hastert. He also ran the speaker's PAC called Keep Our Majority and also been involved in a lot of Republican campaigns in the state of Illinois, including Mark Kirk's campaign for the United States Congress, also involved in the Senate campaign, and also Bob Dold, who is the new congressman from the North Shore who replaced Mark Kirk. Also got a boost from John McGovern. Also joining us this evening is Steve Sevelick. He is the co-coordinator of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots. He is a healthcare consultant and got involved. Tell us again, for those who did not hear your last visit on this program, what prompted you to move from behind the scenes to get involved in politics? What was the last straw for you?
I got activated like a lot of people after hearing Rick Santelli's rant on the floor of the Board of Trade. Went to my first Tea Party rally on February 27th of 2009 and haven't stopped since. And I got more involved with the healthcare debate since that's the field I work in. And I'm so glad, Ray, that you're okay and that you got in before Obamacare fully kicks in 2014. So
I would have been better off if it would have kicked in. But
not if you're the British head of the NHS who just died waiting for stomach surgery.
You could have been before the death.
You're too young to be cynical, okay, Steve?
Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Austin, Texas. Jeff is listening to us on KLBJ, one of our great affiliates. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yeah, I'd just like to say, I don't think this is rocket science. You know, I'm an average American citizen. I'm 50 years old, and I was always taught if you make $100, you spend 80 and you save 20. And you don't spend what you don't have. And that's the way I have to live my life. I pretty much lived it. The average American citizen, at least the younger generation, I agree with what the one gentleman on there has gone far beyond, you know, in terms of living on credit, because we want things now, instant gratification. Multiply that by 10, and that's our government, because nobody wants to say no. Now, what's going to happen? An economic tsunami of monumental proportions is on the horizon in the next 5 to 10 years, and something drastic's not done now. And nobody wants to face it. We created this as a nation, and we have to fix it, because it's going to happen if we don't. And that's pretty much my comment.
Well, that's your point about if we don't fix it now, significant, catastrophic activity on the horizon. That was certainly the message that came loud and clear from Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican of Michigan, who was the chairman of the House Budget Committee. He will present the 2012 budget this coming Tuesday. He gave Chris Wallace a preview today. And, Steve, you were listening. Everybody was listening to his words. He painted a pretty bleak picture.
It is. And if you look at all the crisis that the United States has faced in the last 10 years, we had 9/11, we had Hurricane Katrina, we had the collapse of Lehman Brothers in the stock market. This crisis is completely predictable. The president's own debt commission said that we see this is coming and we have to make changes. So what Paul Ryan is advocating, a cut of $4 trillion over 10 years, that's very modest and something needs to be done.
Well, and I think it's also, it's more than, per the caller's point, we don't know what's going to happen with the economy. We could have a double dip recession. We could have, you know, we're obviously having a rather anemic recovery at this point, which is, you know, it's very precarious about where things are going to go. And certainly by not addressing the systematic problems of the way our government finances itself is only going to be exacerbated if we continue to have economic uncertainty. And I mean, there's a lot going on here that could converge in, unfortunately, a perfect storm of very bad news.
Do you believe that the first shot of the 2012 campaign, politically speaking, is going to be what starts on Tuesday with the budget discussion of 2012? Is there any other issue that's more important to begin with than that one, in your view, Ray?
Well, I think the budget, and I also think foreign policy, which we're going to talk about later. But
right.
I think the question always comes up in when you bring government and budgets and money and spending together. I'm in favor of cutting, too. And I think most Democrats would be in favor of cutting, too. The issue, and I think Republicans are. The problem always is that we have parties that are partisan. They want to cut certain things and not, as you brought up, pork barrel stuff. I don't want to see social services get the brunt of the cuts. That's what I don't want. But I would support cuts if they were across the board, if they impacted everybody. And if that were the case, and if that's the message of the Tea Party, that's a good message.
And also,
but that
just
doesn't happen in politics. It
you
never
know,
happens.
Another question to you, Steve. And again, the Tea Party, generally speaking, has been focused on fiscal issues and cut, cut, cut. But again, to those members of Congress who want to now cut Planned Parenthood, who want to cut National Public Radio, I mean, especially with Planned Parenthood, that gets into a social issue battle that some Republicans, some conservative Republicans, they've been looking for years to cut this. Do they, in your view, do they help or hurt the overall cause when they tend to want to politicize an issue that that's going to be an absolute non-starter to many Democrats and liberals? And to some Republicans.
Yeah, I don't think they heard it as long as they say, well, this is just a small part of the budget and our overall problem is much bigger, because it is much bigger. And I think that in addition to your 2012 issues, I think the economy is still the number one issue, that it's all jobs. And the debt is related to that, because we have a public sector that is just growing and crushing the private economy. And that's why we don't have any jobs.
Well, and also, you know, I to the point about jobs, I mean, unemployment, the number on Friday was 8.8%. It's down 0.1%. I mean, that's just unacceptable. It's a very anemic
hasn't
recovery.
It been that way, though, for the last 6 years?
No,
haven't we seen
Ray, here's the
rising
point.
Unemployment? Why is it suddenly different when we get President Obama? Like, these issues just miraculously
first
appear?
Of all, Ray, it wasn't that high before. Secondly,
6% was pretty high. We've gone higher.
This isn't even getting at what the real number is. I think probably the effective unemployment number is over probably 12%. And you know that, and per Steve's point, I think that is, you know, that is the most important political issue.
It's funny how we
issue.
Got the Democrat and the Republican right. pointing to the Tea Party.
Well, all I was going
to
say
to your point.
As to your point, I would say, Ray, when Nancy Pelosi took over Speaker of the House, unemployment was 4.7%.
And what was the debt?
Probably about $200 or $300 billion, and now it's 8 times higher.
So, and 4.7% was acceptable back then. It wasn't an issue? Or are you just saying that now that we've gone higher, it is now a problem? My whole point is it was a problem at 4.7%, even though it continues to go higher. We've never addressed the problem. We didn't address it before, And I'm not sure we're addressing it now.
But, Ray, the point is it wasn't addressed when the Democrats controlled Congress. It was not addressed when the Democrats controlled Congress. Now the Republicans control Congress because of this new force called the Tea Party. They now have the reins of power, and they don't want to make the same mistake that the Democrats
made. But they are making the same mistake, and you brought up the issue, and I agree with it. They went right after NPR, and I think NPR is irrelevant. It's a symbol for them that they should have dropped. Go after other issues. Prove to me that they want to cut things that can be cut and have nothing to do with politics, they'll get our support.
Ray, that's what's going to happen starting next week. Right. Paul Ryan is not shy about what he's proposing. These are very dramatic changes.
I hear what
he
says.
Addressing fundamental problems with entitlements
they
and a lot of other issues. And the Democrats are going to be the first ones that are going to come back and scream. And we heard Chuck Schumer on the famous conference call, right, saying, call everybody extreme, and this is all extreme. And they've got their talking points down.
And
they're
the
not
Republicans didn't do that also, let's make it about Obama. Let's not talk about the issues.
Well,
let's call him an extremist.
Let's go to Chris in Wheeling,
Obama
Illinois.
Obama and Democrats come to the table to address these issues.
Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen, I have some very simple suggestions, modest suggestions about how we can save trillions of dollars, and I have a small list. First of all, get out of Iraq, Afghanistan, Algeria tomorrow. That'll save $1 trillion a year. Close U.S. military bases. They're in 150 countries. That'll save hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Go after the war profiteers who were overpaid in Afghanistan and Iraq. We can recapture hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Cut the ag subsidies to the corporate agricultural companies, Archer Daniels Midland, that'll save a lot of money. Go cut immediately the sugar subsidies. That'll save a lot of money. Finally, let's cut corporate welfare. And then the last thing is eliminate military spending all of the projects and programs that even the military doesn't want, but some congressmen want because they're being produced in their district.
Okay.
That'll save several trillion dollars a year.
You're absolutely right. I think everybody at the table would say that's not an easy pill to swallow. But all of that long litany, I want to focus on, give John an opportunity to respond and get everybody a chance to respond to it. And that is, when we have a situation like Libya, it explodes, basically out of nowhere in the wake of what happened in Tunisia, what happened in Egypt. And the question that I want to ask everybody, including those out there watching and listening to the broadcast this evening, is when do we say no to a foreign matter that may have long-term ramifications for the country? Do we just hold up our hands and say, you know what, we're not going to get involved, and we shouldn't be involved in Libya? I want to get your reaction to that and also those around the table when we come back. Back shortly. From Salem, Oregon to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. For those who want to cut the budget, I want to cut the budget. Everybody, at least at this table, says they want to cut the budget. You want to cut. You want to get rid of the deficit. And then along comes Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya. As a Tea Party guy, and the Tea Party usually wants to, they generally don't talk much about foreign policy. What's your answer as a Tea Party member and as a American citizen? What should we be doing in Libya? Because there are costs associated with it. Why should we be spending one dime there?
I actually agree with the last caller. And the function of government is to protect us from our enemies, foreign and domestic. And I don't know if the president has made the case in Libya. And I'd also agree with him that we are overextended all over the world. We have troops in Germany where the Germans are perfectly capable of defending themselves, and that's the case for a lot of other countries. So I think it is something that both parties are going to have to look at.
John?
Well, I think I'd say, first of all, about our commitments in other countries. We it's a little more complicated. We're part of NATO. We're part of alliances. We have longstanding commitments. Whether Iraq and Afghanistan have been fiscally a good decision or not, we have to understand that we're there. We have troops there. We have interests there. Certainly, I think it'd be I think everyone would like to get out of both of those places, but you want to get out in a way that's going to be responsible. As far as Libya goes, I think that's an example of sort of a reckless decision. I mean, no one's really sure why we're there and or what we're doing. First, we weren't going to get involved, and then we are going to get involved, and now we're going to get out and let NATO take over, but we're still going to be paying for part of it. It's just, you know, I think that kind of decision makes people angry because it's very poorly thought through.
Right hand on the
end. I'm going to say that's hilarious coming from a Republican after we spent how many years in Iraq in a war that I think a lot of people felt we should have never gotten into. But I want to save that for the next hour. I want to talk about the finances. I'm going to put the litmus test on the table, and all these people that say, yeah, we should cut all the foreign aid to all these governments, and I absolutely agree. But who's going to stand up and say, okay, let's cut the $5 billion to Israel? That ain't ever going to happen. Let's cut the $1.6 billion to Egypt? I don't think we're ever going to do it. So all this talk about, you know, trimming back money that we spend on foreign governments, it is not going to happen. Those foreign governments have reasons why they're getting the money, and it's very hard to take that money back. I would like to see all our money come back from these foreign countries and put it into our people. We seem to care more about some countries more than we do ourselves. I think that's wrong.
But, I mean, you're just saying it's not going to happen. I mean, that's such a defeatist attitude.
People are going to blow me off and say, well, Ray, you're Arab and, you know, you don't like Israel. And that's not it. You know, my wife and kid will be mad at me for saying it, but When will someone stand up and say, look, we're spending too much money on Israel? Who has the courage to say that? They're not going to do it because politically it is not good. So that's the problem that people in national
I mean, a lot of people would argue that we're spending the right amount of money on Israel. I mean,
right. That's exactly a lot of people would argue that. And they'd argue that we're spending the right amount of money in Libya. We're spending the right amount of money in Egypt.
But you're trying to make you're trying to make everything equivalent across this spending.
I'm trying to say the caller said, let's stop spending all this money on foreign countries, on foreign wars. Let's spend it on ourselves, and that's easier said than done.
You're just saying it can't happen. I mean, I think there's certainly the opportunity to have a systematic review.
I've never seen it happen.
But, I mean, that's defeatist, though. In this environment, doesn't it make sense to take an audit of all this and where we're spending it and why we're spending it?
We've got less than 3 minutes left in this hour of the broadcast, and I want to spend it talking about politics in 2012. And again, by the way, in the next hour, for those listening on radio, we're going to talk about Libya. But I do want to talk about Donald Trump. How serious do you think Donald Trump is as a candidate, John McGovern?
Well, I think he's going to look at the ratings tonight on Celebrity Apprentice and see if they've gone up. I think he's going to look at some of his real estate holdings, whether he's made a few more sales. But, you know, we were joking about this before we went on air. But, you know, I think he's a wild card. You know, he is doing surprisingly well. Of course, he's not a declared candidate. You always do better before you're actually a declared candidate. But, you know, he is attracting certainly a lot of buzz and attention. And he's certainly not shy about being provocative. And I think the jury's open. I think he has made a case for his candidacy being more than just a joke,
a publicity stunt.
A publicity
stunt.
I agree. I think it is a publicity stunt, but I think he could be a serious candidate if he wanted to. I think he's polling at 10%, which just shows you how weak the field is right now and how much people want someone that's a credible alternative to Obama, which it's going to come down to. And it's just hard for me personally to get excited about someone that gave $50,000 to Rahm Emanuel.
Right. I think it always comes down to not how bad or good an incumbent is, but it always comes down to how strong the challenger is. And I think that what you just said, Steve, I totally agree with, that I think that he's very popular now because the opponents of Obama do not have a very strong candidate. I just don't see it out there. But from being a journalist, I love guys like Donald Trump. He knows how to make news. I would have taken him serious if he would have just stuck to what he's good at, which is business, and not gone off the deep end on this issue of the birthers and the issue of whether or not Obama is a citizen or does he have a birth certificate. That tells me that he's going to fly into the popularity side, you know, of this issue rather than do what he does best, run good business.
Does he stake out a percentage of the Republican primary voters And you know what? They may not be the people that you go to your cocktail parties with.
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why.
But you know what? Does he stake out a percentage of them? You're smiling, Steve. Does he?
He's got them already.
Okay, he's got them all.
I mean, but let's... I mean,
they're already staked out, okay? Somebody's already claimed them.
I mean, let's be serious about this just for a second, though. There are a number of people who have questions about that issue.
Yes.
And that does not make those questions illegitimate.
It doesn't make them all nutty?
It does not make them all nutty. Let's be fair. There's a lot of people out there who have concerns about that issue. Secondly, about Trump, he's a different kind of candidate in the sense of he's not a career politician. He's never – you know, he's a businessman, a showman. You know, he is very different from the rest of the field that's out there.
We have begun the discussion about Donald Trump. We'll continue it in the future broadcast. I'm Bruce Dumont. If you're listening to us on radio, stay right where you are. Another full hour talking about Libya after the news. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by political consultant Ray Hanania, Republican political consultant John McGovern, and Steve Sevlich of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in this hour of the broadcast, we're going to be talking about U.S. foreign policy and continuing our discussion of our policy in Libya, which to some is clear, to most it's a little bit confusing, and we're going to be talking about that for the full hour this evening. And I'd like to begin with Ray Hanania, who writes a column for the Jerusalem Post, also author of the book Arabs in Chicagoland, also a Palestinian by
Palestinian
extraction, served in the United States Army.
Air Force. Married to a Jewish wife.
And married to a Jewish wife.
People don't get too angry when I express my views.
So you've brought peace to the homeland, at least to your homeland.
Basically, although it's 2-1 again in my home, and there's a green line in my house. I do have a curfew, but besides that, my wife and son are pretty nice to me.
What is your – and by the way, we should mention, because you mentioned this before we went on the air, last year you were approached by the Libyan government to maybe do some public relations for them in the United States.
Right. Let me just say that, you know, I've always believed the Arab governments have done a poor job of media relations and PR, and I guess that comes from the fact that they're all repressive and they don't believe in free speech for their people. So last year, though, after Gaddafi's government was kind of transitioned out of being designated a terrorist sponsoring country into one that we felt we could work with, they felt that they needed some communications and PR. They did approach me, but I didn't believe that Gaddafi's role as a good guy was going to last more than a few weeks. I'm surprised it lasted this long. So I turned him down.
Why was he a good guy for a while?
I think out of convenience. I think that, you know, Gaddafi's people, I think, were at least smart.
And by the way, I shouldn't say
September 11.
Acceptable. An acceptable
he
guy.
He became a partner with us in the Middle East against al-Qaeda. You got to remember about the thing that people don't understand about these dictators in the Middle East is that they're all – most of them have been secular dictators. Even Saddam Hussein was an avowed enemy of al-Qaeda and the Islamicists. He was a guy who fought the war against the Iranians for 10 years, really kind of pushing a war that we wanted, you know, and that he wanted also. But so there were times when the desires of these dictators, you know, paralleled what we wanted as a country. And I think at one point after September 11th, Gaddafi realized that, look, this is a good opportunity for us to get out of the shadow of this, you know, this cloud of being a terrorist organization, come clean or as clean as possible. I never believed he did on the Lockerbie, you know, issue, but they did make steps to kind of address those issues, and we accepted them.
John McGovern, your reaction. We should mention John McGovern once upon a time was press secretary to House Speaker Dennis Hastert, who was the Speaker of the House on 9/11, and was the Speaker, and you were the press secretary to him at a time when the United States was looking for friends all over the world, in the Arab world. When did Gaddafi get on our good side? And what is it that he has done that got him on the bad side again, so that he's getting bombed?
I think the answer to the second part is he started bombing his own people. I think it's pretty,
yeah, that'll usually do it.
But, you know, to Ray's point, I think Ray's right that a lot of these repressive governments in Arab and Middle Eastern countries, they're scared of al-Qaeda because they want to retain their grip on power.
Right.
And I think – I do agree. I think probably Gaddafi saw – well, now's my time to send a signal to the world that I'm not as bad as everybody thinks I am.
This is a good opportunity for him, and he took it.
And I don't think he was ever a good guy or someone that we ever embraced as a newfound ally. He mitigated his terror, if you will, by trying to be more reasonable and acceptable.
And allegedly giving up his weapons of mass destruction.
You know, and I
ending his nuclear program.
Ending his program, which, again – how far along was it? We don't know.
I think he figured out that Saddam Hussein didn't have a nuclear weapons program, but if we believed he did, I think he was smart enough to say, well, I'm going to give mine up.
Whether I have it or not, I'm going to give it up.
I don't think he really had it, but I think he just stepped in there.
But you know, so obviously he was trying to moderate, if you will, his world profile. And this thing happened so fast, this wave, whether it's Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, now Syria, all these places, he got caught up in something that was really domestic. It really had nothing to do with his position on the world stage.
Steve, you're a member of the Tea Party movement, a coordinator in the Chicagoland area. What's your view on our policy in Libya? Are we doing the right thing or the wrong thing there?
I don't know, I think is the answer. I don't know that we've had any leadership from President Obama on this. It seems like we're going along with our allies and that France is leading a lot of this because they have oil interests in Libya. And I think that's interesting because back in the 80s when Reagan bombed Libya because we had American security interests at risk, France didn't even let us use their airspace. And now we're using American treasure and blood to help France out. I just think that the policy seems to have changed on the
dime. But if we have asked France for help in the past, sometimes they've helped us, sometimes they've not helped us. Now if France and Britain are looking for some help here, what's wrong with the United States helping as we are doing under the NATO flag?
Well, is it France and Great Britain or is it France and BP? That's the question. And we should be going to war over American interests rather than European.
But also, I mean, is it also the Libyan people? I mean, is there an argument to be made here that this is such a repressive regime that we have a responsibility in whatever way, and I agree with Steve, I think this has been, there's been no leadership, which I think is the problem on this. There's not been a clearly articulated reason or doctrine or explanation for why this matters.
Where our policy seems to have changed on the dime because Gaddafi's son was in the United States in February, and the State Department brought him in. He toured NASA, and he toured the Air Force Academy, maybe to snap pictures of the bombs that were just about to be dropped in his country. I don't know.
Blueprints.
But it seems like if you're going to be going to war with a country, you probably don't want to have the son of the dictator in your country a few weeks beforehand.
Listen, the only part that I disagree with in all this is that I wish Steve and the Tea Party were here in 2003, and because I believe they would have said the same thing, that Bush going into Iraq, that we would have raised the same questions that we're raising about Libya. I didn't hear that argument back in 2003, and that is exactly the argument we should have heard. Why are we in Iraq? Now, it's too late to go back over, you know, spilled milk, but I think that that question is a legitimate question to ask, but it seems like a double standard that we ask it now with Libya, but we didn't ask it from the same people asking it in 2003.
Another legitimate question that should be asked is now that we have at least engaged Libya, to what extent should be our role? The signal from the White House is that we want to reduce that role. But we have members of the United States Senate, Marco Rubio from Florida and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. They've suggested that maybe we should step up our action, put some troops on the ground, U.S. troops on the ground to topple Muammar Gaddafi. Your reaction to that when we come back to Chicago. From Abilene, Texas to Spokane, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. We'll bring some callers into the conversation in just a bit. But, Ray, I wanted to get your reaction to the president's address on the issue of Libya recently. Took a lot of hits from a number of people, but what did you think of it?
Well, as we were talking about during the break, and I think that there are some legitimate concerns, and we can talk about this now. I think that there is a debate about, does he have his policy? Is it clear? But you know what? We were reacting to a crisis where civilians were being killed, and I don't think we have the luxury to sit there and spend weeks and say, okay, what should our policy be? Should we lobby the Congress? I know the criticism against him is he didn't lay the groundwork properly. I think that going in there and trying to save civilians at the expense of maybe not doing it the proper way in Congress is a good thing.
John?
Well, I think it also brings up the old adage, you can't be half pregnant, right? I mean, you either say it's not in our national interest to be there regardless of what's going on, or it's important for us to stand up for freedom and, you know, help
everywhere
and everyone, and we have a compelling interest to be there.
But we don't always do that.
That's the point, right?
You help everyone everywhere?
We can't.
When we have the budget issues that we have now, we are very selective in our foreign policy, Steve. Why are we doing this in Libya, and why did we not do it in Syria?
It's a good question, and I agree with Ray. We can't. You have the same situation in Syria where you have a dictator that has used poison against his own people. And when Obama was talking about the rebels in Libya, he said, well, they're doctors and they're lawyers, so we know we can trust them. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. If you look at Al-Qaeda, the number two in Al-Qaeda is Zawahiri. He's a doctor. Assad in Syria, he's a doctor. So I don't know that we can trust the people there.
I'm not sure we're supposed to make the world safe for doctors and lawyers,
right? I think there's a domestic political side to this whole Libya thing also. And that goes back to what we were talking earlier. You know, beginning in the 70s, Muammar Gaddafi started investing money in the African-American community in this country. Heavily Democratic, pouring money into it. It was one of the reasons why so many African-Americans converted from Christianity, became Muslims. The Nation of Islam built up on a lot of this money from Libya and Saudi Arabia. And I think that there is a constituency issue out there that plays into that today.
Well, but I think what's interesting is, you know, the president's initial reaction was to do nothing. And it took the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and a couple other people within the administration to say, we have a responsibility to stand up and help these people, which then, of course, shifted shifted his position, and now we're going back to NATO.
Isn't that consistent with his reaction to Tunisia and Egypt? He didn't want to get involved there either.
Well, right, Ryan. But that's my point. So, and I think Steve makes a good point about Syria. I mean, we know what Assad and the Syrian government, we know who they, you know, who they're involved with. Yeah. We know who they fund and we know what they do.
Are we going to go into Jordan, though?
But I mean, that's the point. There's not been an articulated reason.
Listen,
What is the difference in your view, to answer the question about consistency here? Okay, his reaction to Tunisia, his reaction to Egypt. When you had all kinds of reaction coming from the administration, one saying, you know, right. Mubarak was not a dictator, and
right.
the vice president saying that, and then
Hillary
Clinton talking about a stable government
It's like a monopoly board in the Middle East, and we have some countries that are our buddies and some countries that are not. They're all dictators. As some of them are benevolent. In Jordan, he's the king, but he has absolute power. You say something bad about him, you go to jail. We tend to turn our eyes away from that type of problem. Libya is a clear-cut case where the guy is a fanatic and it's easy to go after him. And I think that Obama's policy was consistent to this respect. He didn't want to go into any of those countries, but it was too compelling to stay away from Libya.
Why is Libya more compelling?
because he's openly and more aggressively killing his civilians than the other countries.
I don't think
we
that's,
cannot
I mean,
invade every Arab country.
What
about Bahrain?
What happened in Syria? I mean, that was probably. I don't know what the exact numbers are,
but here's
it was
the point.
Do you believe,
John? You said a few moments ago you can't be just half pregnant here. Do you believe now that we're at a particular point that we should move beyond where we are right now and get some American troops, more American troops involved there, and literally move to regime overthrow?
Well,
we want a regime change.
You're talking about Libya.
Yeah, in Libya.
Well, personally, and this is my personal view is I would be very wary about committing troops. I think that's a big decision. I think there is some case to be made for actively helping the rebels, whether it's some funding, whether it's some military assistance, whether it's equipment.
Doing some training.
Right. I can see the argument for that because, now we're pulling out. We're going to let NATO do it. I mean, at some point, somebody's going to have to do something on the ground. And shouldn't it be the rebels that are the ones that can make this happen?
Steve, you like that idea?
No. I think anything that happens in Libya is going to have the support of the American people. And I think President Obama is going to have to get our support on that. And before we jump in too quickly.
You don't think he has it now?
Well, he clearly doesn't by the polls. And we have to know who these people are that we're supporting. I mean, in that famous letter that Gaddafi wrote to Obama where he called him my son, he mentioned that he's fighting al-Qaeda. So
he says that to everybody.
Yeah. Right.
In every letter to everybody, he will say that.
Donald Trump can calm down on that one.
Let's not be pejorative against Obama that he was called a son.
I'm just saying that Gaddafi said, how can you help me deal with al-Qaeda? And maybe he's right.
Right.
Well, I think Steve's point is right. I mean, I don't think you just flood money and support into a system that you don't know anything about. And that's why I think certainly troops
would
be
too late. It's too late. We're going to have to go into that country. And I'm going to tell you why. If Gaddafi is thrown out of office, the one thing that happens when you take the tyrant out of power, al-Qaeda and these Islamicists will come in and fill the void. Yeah. And that's not in our best interest. We're boxed in here. And if this had happened in Bahrain, we would do the same thing. We have no choice. We have to do that.
But I guess that gets back to the original question. Why did we box ourselves in with such a sort of ill-thought-through
Let's go
policy?
To James in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. He wants to weigh in on this issue. What do you say, James?
Well, guys, I mean, back, I think, in 81, we tried to think about, and I think we'd injured his son or killed one of his sons, but the guy was a terrorist from the 80s. I mean, he was implicated in the Discotheque bombing and the Pan Am flight. So we do need to go in there and take him out with our Apaches and our drones.
Why just him, though? Why just him?
Why not all of them?
None of them are any different.
Well, the difference is he was in Daesh. We know he was sponsored terrorism.
So was the president of Syria. So were many of the Arab countries. So even in a way, even Mubarak was closing his eyes to what was happening with Gaza and the Hamas. So why him, though?
Let's go to Tom in Brookings, Oregon, listening to us on KGOE. Nice to hear from Oregon tonight. Haven't heard from the state of Oregon for many, many months.
Thank you. And I'm enjoying your program and I wish I was more articulate and had more time to think this out because I'm going to be treading on thin ice, I believe.
Okay.
Perhaps you all can help me. Last week I heard you talk about this subject in a little broader term very briefly, and it has to do with our relationship with Israel, and I'm just wondering if the decision point will be tilted in part, or not totality, but in part, by what Israel wants us to do when it comes to stabilizing things in the Mideast. Is the question maybe, is it way too marginal or way too far stream or off the wall to consider that Israel's going to have some say in what we do in any of these countries that we get involved with and how long we stay?
I think Israel was more concerned about what happened in Egypt because they're a partner. There's a peace agreement that they know is going to be in jeopardy if there is a new government in Egypt. The people in Egypt never favored that agreement. Sadat put it in place. He was assassinated. Mubarak has held the line for us. Israel was more concerned about Egypt. I don't think Israel, they dislike the Libyans, but I don't think that they viewed the Libyans as being more, more of a direct threat the way a change in Egypt would be to their country.
But here, let's look at it in the broader context. I mean, When you look at Tunisia, you look at Egypt, you look what's happening, you know, throughout the Middle East, including Libya. This is a significant time in the history of the world, what's happening right now.
It is
amazing. Which we as Westerners, we are viewing in a positive way. We say, okay, this is the thirst for freedom. This is the march for democracy. These are the young people of the Middle East. They're turning against the tyrants. We don't see, at least apparently, a lot of burning American flags, at least at this moment. That, you know, we don't know what they're thinking, but we're not seeing those pictures. Does that explosion and that thirst for freedom and the road that appears to be the road many in the Middle East are walking down, is that, in your view, Ray, a threat to Israel long term?
Look, freedom and justice are double-edged swords. You can't demand justice in one area and then close your eyes to justice in another area. It certainly does put pressure on Israel, where they can do things, they can have policies that we will not criticize them for, and we sometimes should. We vetoed our own policy. We are against illegal settlements, you know, in the West Bank. It's our policy, and yet when it came up to the United Nations, we had to veto that. We vetoed our own policy. So you can't ask for justice on one side and not expect that same blade is going to come back, you know, as a pendulum and slice through the other side. I think long term, if the Israelis are smart, and I do believe they are our main concern in the Middle East, if they are smart, they're going to resolve this conflict with the Palestinians. That's going to give them some insulation from the changes in the Middle East. That's what I believe.
I want to get a reaction from our other guests to that same question. We do have to pause for a break. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to weigh in on the same subject, the impact, the long-term impact on Israel to what we're seeing in the Middle East, which may be one of the great collective revolutions of our lives. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Ray Hanania is here. He is a former journalist. He's a political consultant. He is author of the book Arabs of Chicagoland, former stand-up comic, and also a columnist for Jerusalem Post. Also with us this evening is John McGovern. He is the former press secretary to House Speaker Dennis Hastert, and also is the executive director of the Speaker's PAC called Keep Our Majority. Also has given advice to newly elected Republican Congressman from Illinois, Bob Dold. And also joining us this evening is Steve Sevlik. He is the co-coordinator of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots, and also he's a healthcare consultant. We're going to go back to calls in just a moment, but I want to get everybody's reaction to the story of and the coverage of the preacher from Florida who decided to burn the Quran. My question to you, John McGovern, has the media covered this story too much, not enough? And what do they do next? Because people like that tend to live on publicity, and it looks like he's getting his share of it with a lot of dead people in the wake.
You know, I think the obvious answer is yes, it's been overcovered. It's sensationalized. It's a stunt. I'm not sure what impact on any of the debate it has had other than to make people angry. I would hope that there would be a little more judgment by the media in covering these things, but of course we know that's not going to happen. So unfortunately, people like that are continually going to have a platform to do those kind of things.
Ray, what's the impact of
Hate to say that the media is fueling the flames, because I still do a one-hour Middle East program on Fridays. It's simulcast in Chicago and Dearborn to the Arab community called Radio Baladi. And he's going to be on our show Friday. So we are probably flaming the fires there.
You're part of the problem, right?
But why are you having him on?
I want to confront him and my co-host, who is a Muslim woman who wears a hijab. We want to confront him. And we want to get him to explain his logic. Why is he burning a Quran? Why? I don't understand why somebody would do that outside of hatred. And that seems to me that he's exploiting the hatred maybe for his own popularity. He's getting a lot of attention. But, you know, we feel like this need. We want to ask him point blank, face to face, why are you doing that?
Steve, your reaction.
Well, I think when Ray talks to him, he's going to probably confront him with words as opposed to violence. And that's what we're seeing around the country, around the world. So I think the media does fuel into this, and they're giving him way too much attention. And I think the reaction we're seeing in Afghanistan is just out of control.
Ray, we should mention you are not a Muslim.
No.
But everybody thinks I am. But everybody thinks you are. But I want to ask the question because I've heard a number of people discuss this over the last several years, whether it is the case of the Florida preacher, whether it's the case of the cartoonist.
Presidential candidate saying he won't appoint any Muslims to office if he's elected president.
Whatever the case may be, there is a sense that Muslims are very, very sensitive, extremely sensitive. Obviously, it is the holy book. The Quran is the holy book. But how do you explain to non-Muslims why some Muslims are so sensitive to a cartoon, which to most Americans doesn't mean much?
It's a complex problem. Not all Muslims are like that. A very small minority are, but that small minority can put together a demonstration, destroy a city, whether it's in Lebanon, whether it's in Afghanistan, whether it's in any other country outside of the Muslim world. They do get very emotional about it, but I would say that a lot of it has to do with they live in repressed countries where they don't have free speech. They're not allowed to vent. They can't complain about their governments. But governments will allow them to do certain things like vent against the United States, focus on the burning of a Quran. They're allowed to do that. And in a way, it's the system that, you know, stokes the flames. I would think that conservative Jews would be very unhappy if somebody came to Chicago and went to the North Side and said they were going to burn a copy of the Torah. You know, that would anger me, but I don't think that they would go to the streets and start rioting. But I bet there would be a small segment,
You had the case of the American Nazi Party leader that wanted to march in Skokie, which was where a lot of the victims of the Holocaust.
One of my first assignments at the Southtown when I was a newspaper reporter in the 70s was to cover the guy, I can't remember.
Frank Collins. C-O-L-I-N.
Right, Frank Collins, I think, was his name. And
O.S.
You're right. There was a Jewish Defense League that was there. They were threatening, you know, to fight, to kill this guy. So the difference, though, is here in our country, people have the ability to express themselves in a lot of different ways. Just like you said, we're not going to go kill anybody. I want to bring him on radio to just understand where this hate comes from, but I think it's more of a strategy on his part. He knows that there's a button that can be pressed that will get him international attention.
Well, and I think that's the point. And obviously the great thing about this country is everyone is free to express themselves
right.
in whatever way they want, whether someone else finds it distasteful or not. That doesn't mean you need to have 12 camera crews there covering it and broadcasting it around
the world. You may lose your job like Helen Thomas. What was the other reporter? I can go through Octavia Nasser and Rick Sanchez, I think.
Right.
So, yeah, those people in these Muslim countries, they don't see that it's a red button issue we do.
But someone like Helen Thomas, she has a right to express herself. She does not have a right to her job.
Well, then nobody does.
My point is,
nobody has
point,
a right,
right
to their job.
That's a whole other issue.
But the point I'm trying to make is you're right. We can express ourselves, and we have consequences in a different way.
We have people that want to express themselves. Let's go to John in Alamogordo, New Mexico, the land of enchantment, listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
I was listening to you. You're a liberal guest there for every reason why he could justify why it was okay to be in Libya. He discounted the reasons why we were in Iraq. In 91, when I was there, I would say I'm a 28-year military officer still in. Saddam Hussein went in and invaded Kuwait and was going to go to Saudi Arabia if we wouldn't have stopped it. After we left in 91, there was massive death he inflicted on the Kurds, where he wiped out towns. Then he violated the no-fly zone. I mean, he had multiple options to remain in power if he wouldn't have just gone crazy. And so it's very easy to understand why you can't say Iraq, because it was Bush's war, is not the same thing that's going on in Kuwait, except most officers right now in the military can't even tell you why we're in Libya.
Well, but you're not understanding my point. My point is exactly your point. I'm wondering why we made the argument to invade Iraq, and now we're questioning, you know, whether we should or should not invade Libya. Yes, I think we should invade Libya. I think, unfortunately, the war in Iraq, we can't find the soldiers to send to Libya if we wanted to.
Well, here's the problem, though. As a military officer and done five tours overseas already.
And I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served during the Vietnam War. My brother was a Marine. My father and uncle served in
this
country, too.
We can't tell who the enemy is. It would be like walking in the middle of a FedEx Stadium in Washington, D.C., and trying to pick out the 10 people who are the terrorists or who are the ones that you need to fight because everybody's wearing...
And that was the same during the Vietnam War. It was no different in Vietnam than it is in Iraq or Libya. It's the same challenge we always – but we're better than these other countries. Our job is to be more cautious and not take an action when it might result in the killing of civilians. That's where I've always disagreed with what we've done in Iraq.
Well, let me ask you this question. Why would Obama say that Mubarak needs to step down and he wouldn't say that about Gaddafi, other than the fact that Mubarak –
That's a fair criticism.
Protecting Israel.
That's a fair criticism, but it doesn't change anything regarding the other debate we had about Libya and Iraq. I'll agree with
you
that Obama should have been tougher on Libya. I'll concede that. He should have been tougher on Libya. But why not be tougher on the prince, the sheikh in Bahrain, who's also killing people? Why not be tougher with the president of Syria, who's also killing people?
And I'll say one thing, doing three tours in Iraq and two in Afghanistan, I never saw the French over there helping us. I didn't see the Germans ever over there. So now the Brits were very good. The Dutch were good at helping us. The Italians were very good. Let France take care of this themselves, because if you remember in 1981, France wouldn't let us cross their airspace in Operation El Diablo Canyon.
But Italy doesn't want to help us this time.
Well, I don't blame them. There's no clear defined
goals. That's not why they don't want to help us, though.
John, let me ask you this question as a military man, and again, thank you for your service to the country. My question to you is, what role do you feel the United States has in engaging in humanitarian issues or to stop massive bloodshed in any part of the world? What should our criteria be?
I tell you what, that's a tough question. You know, we faced the same problem when we had our own civil war back in 1861. Sometimes you just have to fight it out within your own country. We can't give them weapons right now because we don't even know who we're giving it to. Plus, you can't give weapons and money guys like that because we'd have to be over there to, number one, teach them how to use it. We'd have to make sure that they didn't take the money and run off with it. I mean, civil affairs, it's a very difficult thing to ride around out there and give money trying to buy friendship, to get information. I mean, it's a big, big ordeal. We either in for a penny or in for a pound. And, I mean, you just can't go over there and do what we're doing in Libya without going in there all the way. The best thing to do is to sit back, let things take their course, and look, the rebels cannot win this.
Okay, listen, on that note, we have a military man calling from New Mexico, says no troops on the ground in Libya. In fact, doesn't want to move forward in Libya, unlike some United States senators. Back shortly from Chicago.
Fender, I like her.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. I just told a little joke during the break there. Go ahead and make the point you just made, and I'll put it on the air.
Listen, the most depressing part was seeing the Libyan woman who alleged that she had been gang raped by Gaddafi's guards. And rather than having some sympathy to see these women that were covered jumping all over her and attacking her. It wasn't just a, you know, the politics. There was religion involved. This woman was a secular woman that made the allegation. She wasn't covered. So it was just disturbing to see women not sympathize with a woman like that. That's how intense, you know, the politics are in the Middle East. And it's sad to see that.
And I said in the United States, if somebody was beating up Sarah Palin, don't expect a lot of feminists to go in there and stop the fight.
But chivalrous men who think she's good looking might have.
Let's go to Mike in Spokane, Washington, listening to us on KXLY, one of our oldest affiliates. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Bruce, and always thank you for having us on the air, and thanks for taking my call.
Well, listen, hey, I want you to call up the program director there, because I think we've been on the air almost 17 years out there, and so you tell him that you appreciate Beyond the Beltway every Sunday night.
I will do that. I will talk to him, yeah. And White Sox are off to a good start.
Yes, they are. 2-1.
Yeah, you bet. God bless. Well, my question is, where is China and Russia in the Middle East, Libya and other places? And what if Russia or China decide to oppose us because of oil or other reasons? What do we do then in this nuclear age?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, I think Russia has been rather vocal about their unhappiness with our decision to get involved. China, you never know where they are. I mean, where are they with North Korea, right?
They're making money somehow on this whole thing.
They're not exactly leaders on the international stage on these kind of things. They've got probably enough of their own issues they don't want to be talking about in within their own borders.
But this also goes back to the discussion we had just a little bit earlier. Why are we in it, and why isn't France, you know, as enthusiastic? We're the only country.
Why France is and why Italy is not, you were saying.
Right. Well, my point is that we are the leader of the free world. We are. Well, it's not the Soviet Union, China, and the United States anymore. It's the United States. That means we have a special responsibility, I think, where we have to make these decisions. Callers, people are going to say, why are we doing it? Why don't we let these other countries do it? But they're not the ones that are saying that they're the leader of the free world, that they're not the people that are defending democracy. That's our job. I think that's what we do. And that title, you know, bears a responsibility that we have to pursue.
But we're almost seeing, in a certain sense, almost an 18th century version of spheres of influence in different countries and different regions trying to protect alliances, right, protect whether it's economic, whether it's cultural, whether it's religious. I mean, Russia obviously has an interest in what goes on in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan. It's along its borders, the former Soviet states. I mean, there's a lot of very deep, long-standing relationships that they don't want the U.S. infringing on.
But one of the things, you know, you alluded to Italy, is Italy having maybe significant business interests in
long-standing
in
relations with Libya.
Right. And so the question is, that's one of the reasons why they're not engaged,
right,
at this
particular
moment.
It's not because
they're
not patriotic or they don't want to support
just
freedom.
Just as the case, and again, this is, you know, I don't want to make a case necessarily for France, because France has usually been on the wrong side of a lot of issues.
Except when they fought with us against the British.
But,
okay.
But the point is, the answer to the question of why France did not join the coalition of the willing in the Iraq war is they had significant business interests in Iraq. It wasn't
that
in their best interest, even though we like to think everybody should be on the side of good versus evil, when there's business interests involved.
But they also
They follow their business interests, just like the United States follows its business interests.
They also
interests.
Have a much larger than other countries immigrant Arab and Muslim community in France that Italy doesn't have that
which
large
they
of
are,
population.
Which they are afraid of, yes.
Well, yeah, well, they're, you could say afraid of
Western
or
Europe
sensitive
is afraid,
to
is,
or the, more considerate
I say,
to.
I
right.
would say afraid of,
that could be a
given
debated
the bonfires
point, right.
I've seen that have destroyed neighborhoods in France.
Absolutely.
Well, and also the debate in the French Parliament about wearing headdresses and all that kind of things. And,
right.
you know, if you look at the French colonial sphere, it's Algeria, Tunisia. Tunisia is a major
Lebanon.
You know, and
right.
Tunisia obviously is the country that started this all. And, you know, so France, it's sort of interesting. They do a dance, right? It's like Libya or Italy. Italy has that colonial relationship with Libya. And I wonder what the United States would do
if we saw a revolt in Dubai, where we have huge financial interests. I wonder how aggressively we would be. So you're right. I mean, in fairness, you know, I don't think we should single France out and say, oh, they don't care about freedoms or whatever. I think it does have to do with what are our interests in a country, what's at stake for us, how many people will it impact. We have to weigh all of that, and we don't totally understand.
Well, but let's be
but
fair.
I think what happens, and I want to get Steve's reaction, it seems to me that one of the things that happens that Americans have done, because Americans do not travel as much as Europeans travel. And I think that creates in many minds especially when a world crisis arises, and we are, as you say, we're the strongest nation on earth. We've become, the policeman of the world. We expect everyone, whenever there's a conflict, to fall in lockstep behind us because we believe we are right. We believe that we're on the right side, and we believe that we've drawn a line between the good guys and the bad guys. But what we don't take into consideration is the alliances, the business relationships that a lot of these countries have with each other, which is why it allows France to go one way when the Iraq war comes along, and suddenly everybody, we don't even want to call them French fries anymore because we think they've been disloyal to us.
Well, but let's
that isn't necessarily the case.
But let's also remember that they have a responsibility as part of NATO, as an ally, that
yes.
There are, it's not always okay to go your own way.
But NATO did, but I believe France did provide some of the flights. I mean, one of the most interesting things of the 9/11 experience was the NATO flights that were flown over the United States by NATO countries. And I believe that France was involved in that.
Well, they may have been in that instance, but it doesn't mean that when they go it alone, it's always appropriate.
I understand that. On that note, we have to say farewell to Ray Hanania. Thanks very much for being with us, Ray. Steve Sedlick from the Tea Party. John McGovern, a Republican political consultant. They have all joined us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman helped make this program possible. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.